Today we enter the final portion of Isaiah. As a reminder, I'm going to put up an outline of the whole book. We are entering today the book of the conqueror. And as you look through that outline, just as a way of reminder, the first five chapters were an introduction to the book of Isaiah. And then in 6 through 39, kind of, because chapter 6 is Isaiah's call and commission, but in 6 through 39 you have the book of the king, and then you have the next section, which we did over the last 3 weeks, which is the book of the servant. And today we enter the book of the conqueror, which is the last 11 chapters of the book of Isaiah. And I don't know how many of you maybe panicked when I sent out that text this week about what we are covering this week. So I apologize for that I didn't have space in there to explain why. And honestly, at the time, because it was actually Thursday, and I usually try to send out on Wednesday, but that kind of shows you where I was at for preparation this week. But at the time, even Thursday, I didn't necessarily have a way to shortly explain why I was doing it. But you will find out as I go. And honestly, I have been trying to find a different way to present these last chapters, because I am aware that this is a large chunk to look at all at once. And it is not necessarily my preferred way of doing it, unless Caleb and I are doing sometimes what we do in Sunday school, which is just the story of the Bible, and we do huge swaths all at once. So I have tried, I swear, to find a different way. But I was not able, at least with the time I had and with the frustration I was dealing with, I was not able to find what I consider to be a better or more clear way to finish this book. And that has been my goal throughout this whole series, is to be clear and to be helpful. And I wanted to make sure that as we finish this book, that it is going to be helpful. And to me, this was the best way to do it. All 11 chapters of this last section, the Book of the Conqueror, are working together for one message. And what makes it even more complicated, and I'll explain this later, is that the last 11 chapters, broken up in various ways by various commentators, and I kind of made my own, but it is a chiasm, which is basically that the main theme is at the middle. So how do you break a chiasm in half? That was a struggle that I had this week and the weeks leading up to this, and I decided that I'm not going to, because I don't think it would have been as helpful to do the chiasm in two halves as it is going to be to do it in whole. I also am aware that this means that I am definitely not going to go verse by verse, even remotely close to verse by verse, or even paragraph by paragraph. But what I hope is that today I'll be able to give you a framework for these last chapters, and that will be helpful as you continue to study these. Because this sermon, as in all the sermons, I am not going to answer all your questions, and I am very aware of that. So please, I am hoping that this kind of lights a fire in you to continue looking at the book of Isaiah. Also, I will be doing a Q&A still. And if you're curious, by the way, about the pacing of the sermons, I am finishing Isaiah today. Next week, though, part of the reason that I'm doing this whole last section today is what I want to do next week, which is next week, along my path of like trying just to be helpful with the book of Isaiah as we leave it, is next week I'm going to do kind of a split sermon where the first part of it is going to be a summary of the whole book of Isaiah. And I feel like that's going to be helpful because we've been a long time in a very long book. So I want to do a summary of Isaiah for the first part of the sermon. And then the second part of the sermon, I'm going to stress this, a sampling of the New Testament use of Isaiah. And it will simply be a sampling because Isaiah, I just confirmed again this morning because I want to make sure I didn't misspeak. Isaiah is the most quoted Old Testament book in the New Testament. Psalms is second. And keep in mind, Psalms has 150 Psalms, but it is still second to Isaiah in how often it is quoted. So again, next week will be a sampling. What I'm hopefully going to try to do is like a kind of thematic look at how the New Testament is using Isaiah and give some specific examples. I know that I haven't had time in all of these sermons to do much of the New Testament crossover. I've tried at times to kind of hint at it or talk about it real briefly. We'll do that a little bit again today, but I want to do that more in earnest next week. And then the following week, the week before Easter, will be the Q&A, and then I will be done, and Caleb will be doing the Easter sermon and then starting a new series the week after that. So that's an overview of where we're going. But because we are doing all 11 chapters today, and as I was researching into the 11 chapters, I realized that I have to go over the chapters I skipped last week, which are 44 and 45, the end of the book of the servant, in order for us to understand why I am framing these last 11 chapters the way that I am, because context is key, or king, whatever phrase you want to use, but we need the context going in. So because of all that, I'm covering 11 chapters. I'm covering the two chapters going into the 11 chapters. I apologize in advance if I don't look up much from my manuscript after this introduction, where I'm looking up a lot. Because if I go off script too much, we will be here all day. So I apologize if I'm looking down a lot in this particular sermon. And I also want to just tell you, buckle up, because we're about to cover a lot of text really fast. I will slow down at the beginning, because I feel like the beginning helps us understand it, and then after that, we're going to fly. So here we go. First thing I want to do, and I'm going to put this up as a reminder, the first thing I want to do is, like I said, we need to look at the two chapters, the final chapters of the Book of the Servant. So we're going to look at 54 and 55 in order to give us the context that helps us to understand what Isaiah is trying to say and present in 56 to 66. And again, like I talked about the last 3 weeks, in the Book of the Servant, you effectively have, as the opening, you have the need for the servant, to the task of the servant. And I actually realize I have not the whole Book of the Servant up there, just the last part of it. I meant to do the other outline, but this still works. So in the chapters before, what is up there on the outline, you have the call. God is going to comfort his people. And he has the promises and the plans. He promises that he is going to deliver them both from bondage to exile and from bondage to sin. And then in the next two sections after that, after you have the promises and plans, you have the plans broken up by stage. You have the plan and the execution of God delivering them from exile. And then what's on the outline right here is God's plan to deliver them from their sin. So that is what is up here on the outline, the final chapters, the deliverance from sin. You have the task of the servant, and then you have the difference between the servant of nation, Israel, lowercase servant, and then the uppercase servant, the Messiah, who's going to actually make all this possible and succeed where the lowercase servant failed. And then you have that salvation that he's going to accomplish is promised and laid out. And then in the next section, you have that salvation accomplished through the beautiful chapter, mostly of 53, a little bit of 52 at the end, but mostly 53. And then after all that, that glorious redemption, that greater deliverance from the bondage of sin, you have a call to respond. And that's what we're looking at right now, 54 to 55. So in light of the work of the servant, which is laid out in specifically 49 through 53, in light of the work of the servant to bear the sin of the people in their place and provide a way of righteousness, a way of forgiveness, a way of salvation, a way of peace, and a way of being counted as righteous. A lot of those come directly from 53 and what is accomplished there. In light of all of this, the call to response in 54 to 55 opens up with "Sing, O barren one, who did not bear, break forth into singing and cry out loud, you who have not been in labor." We need to remember the context to realize the depth of what's happening here. Sing, O barren one. Who is the barren one? Remember that in 40 to 66, these chapters, the Book of the Servant, and then the next one as well, they're written in different ways, but 40 to 55, the Book of the Servant is specifically written to the people in exile, in Babylon. So who is barren? Jerusalem, back home, with no people. Sing, O barren one, sing Jerusalem, sing, O empty place that longs for her children, and you will see children that you didn't even bear. You will find generations, you will find your children when you weren't even expecting them, children that you didn't even look for, is what's being said here. Sing, O barren one. Jerusalem is currently barren, abandoned, empty of its inhabitants. But because of the work of the servant, she will bear children that she wasn't even expecting. And we read in verses 1 through 3 of 54, she's going to have to make more room. She's going to have to enlarge the walls. Make more room for these children. It's going to be more than you're thinking. And then this language here, if you think about this language here and you think back to chapter 49 after the second servant song, and I walked through the servant songs last week, but after the second servant song, Zion or Jerusalem had responded in disbelief, because you had in 42, you had a song of the nations need to look to the servant. And then you had this buildup and this progression that happened between that song and then the second song, which is 49, which basically laid out that the nation of Israel was in just as much need of the servant as the nations around her. So she also had to look to the servant. And then in 49, you had this song of the servant. And then immediately after that, Remember the Song of the Servant saying that the nation of Israel and all the nations need to look to the servant. Immediately after that song, you have the nation of Israel, Zion, disbelieving, which proves her need for the servant. So back then, after that second servant song, Jerusalem had responded in disbelief, but God had responded to her disbelief, and we saw and walked through that, that God had responded to that with promises, that because of the work of his servant, that they would look around, and they would ask themselves, where all these children that they had not even born, where did all these children come from? So it's similar language here in 54 that had been used back earlier in 49. There's a repetition here of this theme and a song for praise, or a call for praise and a song at the fulfillment of this promise. And as you keep reading through these verses here, you see that God, her husband, will gather her back to himself. He was angry with her for a time and cast her off or exiled her due to her shameful, adulterous youth, which was kind of a way of saying her idolatry and her rebellion, which you can read the whole Old Testament for the context of that. But due to his everlasting love, he will redeem her and bring her back. And we see this in verses 5 through 8 of chapter 54. And then as he goes on to talk about this, what he's saying is, as the waters of Noah will not return, so his wrath will not return. And we see this in 9 through 10. And then we also see, continuing forward through chapter 54, we see that the afflicted and the storm-tossed Jerusalem, who is waiting for comfort, she will be comforted because of the work of the servant. And this will be a work of redemption and return that's even greater than the return from exile, just as we walked through in the book of the servant. She will be laid and built with precious stone. In other words, she will not only be restored, but she will be glorified, is what we see in the verses of 11 through 12. Just as the servant was taught directly from God, and we saw this in chapter 50, 4 through 5, just as the servant was taught directly from God, so she and her children will be. And we see this in 54, verse 13. It says, all your children shall be taught by the Lord, and great shall be peace upon your children. They will be established in righteousness, never to be overcome or to fall under the judgment of her enemies, for their righteousness, her vindication, is from the Lord. And if you caught some similarities there between this promise to future Jerusalem and the wording and the claims of the servant, that's all on purpose. Because this will be the heritage of the servants. You read here in 17, no weapon that is fashioned against you shall succeed, and you shall refute every tongue that rises against you in judgment. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their vindication is from me, declares the Lord. The servants, plural, taught by God, helped, vindicated, glorified. These are all the same exact words that had applied to the servant, singular, in the last few chapters. And they now all apply to the servants. We are seeing a morph, a continuing morph of the use of servant imagery here in Isaiah. And we're going to keep seeing it. Because in the opening chapters, all the way as you get to the promise of the servant, you have the nation, the servant, the servants of God, who have failed in their task, and the servant comes and succeeds where they failed to do what they were unable to do. And now here you have those who look to that servant get the same things, the same defense, the same glory, the same righteousness, the same vindication, get the same things. They become the servants, plural. Look to the servant, singular, and you become one of the servants, plural. There's a morphing that's happening here. So because of all of this, 55, come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. This promise of water, this teaching of the people by God that we just talked about, and this making them precious and blessed that we just saw at the end of 54, and the beginning of 55 here, this language here is purposely similar to chapter 43, verse 25 to 44, verse 5. And in that section, that was God's promise of a solution to the problem of their sin. His promise was to blot out their transgressions and open a way for them to be taught directly by him. That was the promise. Now we're looking at the fulfillment, that you will have children taught directly by me after their sins are blotted out by the work of my servant. So the promise was back in 43 and 44, and the fulfillment we see here. This language is repeated here because this is all accomplished by the work of the servant. And if, as you tie these two passages together here and look at the themes, what is being said is that this water imagery is talking of the Spirit. And in 44, it shows us that the work of the servant, if you will, opens up the floodgates of the Spirit. For the pouring of the Spirit will make all of this possible. Just as we saw much earlier in Isaiah, we saw every time we see these promises, this grand restoration, this grand recreation, if you will, and I purposely use that word because we're going to get there, but you see all these grand promises of what God will do for the people, the Spirit is always tied into that. And that's why also the servant, when he enters onto the scene, he said he's the one anointed and who has the servant or the Spirit on him. There's a reason, I'm going to steal some of my New Testament thunder right now. There's a reason that when Jesus comes and does his work, he says, it is better for me to go that I may send the Spirit to you. Because look how the Spirit is constantly tied to the fulfillment of these promises. Jesus knew that. It is because of the servant as well, we see in these verses, it is because of the servant that an everlasting covenant, as you see in verse 3, will be made with the people. The servant will fulfill the promises of David. Like David, but even greater, he will be a witness to the people and a leader and a commander for the people. And then verse 5, it's kind of hard to follow sometimes the pronouns here, so I'm going to do a little grammar spiel just for a minute. At verse 5, you see, behold, you shall call a nation that you did not know. And it's interesting because you read 3 to 5, incline your ear, come to me, hear what that your soul may live, and I will make you an everlasting covenant, my steadfast, sure love for David. Behold, I made him a witness to the peoples, a leader to the commander for the peoples. Behold, you shall call a nation. What is going on with all this switch of pronouns here? What I think is going on is that verse 5 switches into the masculine singular. And I specify that because if you follow through, if you're a grammar nerd and kind of look it all up, if you follow through from beginning of 54 coming into 55 here, the feminine singular has been used for Zion or Jerusalem. And then in 54, the masculine plural, when it's used to represent the peoples. And then here we have a masculine singular, which is, kind of breaks the flow. And I think it's because God has switched back to talking to the servant. Right after he talks about David, he switches almost seamlessly to talking about the servant. And I think it's because the servant, as we've been promised so many times, is the greater David. You have David imagery that suddenly transforms into servant imagery because the servant is the greater David. Behold, you, the servant, shall call a nation that you don't know, and a nation that you did not know shall run to you because the Lord your God and the Holy One of Israel, for he has glorified you. And I think that's still talking about the servant. And the other reason I think that is that the very next verse switches back to the second person masculine, or second masculine the second person masculine plural. There we go. Trying to say it properly. The second person masculine plural, which has been used consistently in 54 to 55 to talk about the nations, the peoples, all who are called to partake in the work of the servant. And this call to response goes out to the people for the rest of the chapter. They are all called to seek the Lord. The wicked and unrighteous are called to abandon their ways and thoughts and seek the Lord, for his ways and thoughts are higher, as we read in these verses. And I think a way of reading that is they're higher. They are greater and better than theirs, which has been the whole point of Isaiah, that your ways, your thoughts, your plans don't work. God's ways are higher and better. They are greater. And then the text, wrong place my notes there. So we have God's ways are better than the ways of the people. The people of the world are called to abandon their ways and pursue his ways. His word, as we read in 10 and 11, his word, which represents his promises, his plans, his ways and thoughts, it will not return empty. It will be accomplished. In Isaiah, we have seen so many times that the ways of those who reject God will end in destruction. They will end in the opposite of what they have planned. But God's ways will end in success and life. Those who put their trust in him will go out in joy and peace and enter a renewed creation, with the effect of the curse reversed, as we read in this beautiful language here at the end of 55. Instead of thorn, there shall come up cypress, and instead of briar, shall come up myrtle, and it shall make a name for the Lord, an everlasting sign. This is a reversal of the curse. It's purposely bringing in the thorn and the briar language and reversing it. So they will go out in joy and peace and enter a renewed creation with the effects of the curse reversed. This renewal, this renewed creation, this will be an everlasting name for the Lord and a sign of his glory. So as we transition back into the flow of the whole book of Isaiah, as you exit this book of the servant, you have this call to response and you have this grand vision of what will be. This promise of joy and this promise of peace and of a future renewal and restoration, it has run all throughout 40 to 55, and we saw hints of it even in 1 through 39. But it comes to its climax here in this grand promise and call to respond to the work of the servant. And that's how the book of the servant ends, a response to call, a call to respond to the work of the servant and a promise for what will be the future for those who do. And all of this is made possible because of the work of the servant. But as we continue into chapters 56 to 66, the book of the conqueror, Isaiah, I think a helpful way of understanding what's going on here in the book is that Isaiah is switching his intended audience. And that's why I have paragraphs up on this outline of the intended audience, kind of where they are, what's going on. So you have the introduction, which I didn't put paragraph because it's the introduction, but it's talking about the people in the land, that there is just complete disregard for God, their religion is fake, and there is a grand work of redemption and deliverance and renewal that needs to happen. You have these glimpses of hope. But by and large, you have judgment in chapters 1 through 5. And then you have some historical setting that anchors 6 to 39. You have the call of Isaiah, and then in 7 through 9, you have the historical setting with Ahaz, and then in 36 to 39, you have the historical setting with Hezekiah. And all of this, all of these chapters, 6 through 39, they all happen in the land. They are calls to the people to trust and look to God while they're in the land. But Isaiah knows that that's going to fail. And then the next section, 40 to 55, talks to the people looking forward, talks to them in exile. Because 39 ended with the note of the promise of the exile to Babylon. And then in 40 to 55, Isaiah is through the eyes of God looking ahead and speaking to those in exile and telling them to look to the promises of God and his plans to deliver them both from this exile, but also from their greater problem, which they consistently show all through the chapters, that the greater problem is their sin. And little sidebar, we shouldn't be too hard on them when I keep knocking on national Israel, whatever, and what's going on here. We're the same way. Jesus needed to save us too. So that's to the side. But so in 6 to 39, you have speaking them in the land, and then 40 to 55, you have them in exile. And then I think he switches audience here, 56 to 66. He is looking even further into the future, and they've come back. But I purposely have back home question mark. Because, like, they're back, but it's not quite, it doesn't appear how they want it to be. And the return wasn't quite what they wanted. We saw that in how they had to grapple with the plan of Cyrus and how it's like, oh, we're coming back, but it's not a Moses. It's this foreign guy and we're still going to be subjugated to him. So we're really not coming back any better than we left. So there's just this big question mark hanging in the air about how they come back. But all that to say, I think he's switched his intended audience, so it's no longer the exiles in Babylon he's speaking to, but those who have returned. They have heard these grand promises. They've seen the deliverance from exile, the fulfillment of those promises. But they wonder how all of this, how all of their situation fits into all of this grand plan and promises of God. The returned exiles, he knew, would misunderstand and struggle to grasp the gradual unfolding of God's plan. These final chapters focus on their disillusionment, their discouragement, confusion, frustration, whatever word you want to put there. They have to grapple with this, and they have to deal with the people having to wait for the total fulfillment of these things. God, through Isaiah, now advises Israel on how to behave while they wait. After painting a glorious picture of what Yahweh's salvation will look like, in Isaiah 40 to 55, he now addresses the more practical reality of living for him in the present. This section is an acknowledgement and an encouragement through present reality. The exiles who returned from Babylon did not experience the fullness of the blessings promised in 40 to 55. Chapters 56 to 66, then, address their current experience within God's larger plan of salvation and of the glorious future reign of the Messiah and the restoration of all things. In other words, what these chapters are addressing is the fact that, yes, some of these things have come true, but we really can tell that a lot of it hasn't. What do we do? What do we do with that? Since Isaiah has given so many prophecies in a way that mix immediate and future elements of God's plan, and I've tried to kind of unwrap that and untangle that as we've gone through the book of Isaiah, but because it's all mixed together, immediate and near future and far future, all these things are mixed together, it makes sense that the people would have been disillusioned and confused, wondering where these fulfillments are. We can look through Isaiah today, and we can look back on how many of the prophecies were gradually fulfilled in whole or in part through the centuries, and how so much was fulfilled in the work of Jesus, the Messiah, and the establishment of the church, which includes people from all nations. But this is a blessing of hindsight that the original audience would not have had. We have to acknowledge that as we read these chapters. And we also, by the way, have not yet to see, or sorry, we also today, by the way, have yet to see the full fulfillment of many of these things. So we are also in a similar situation to the audience then. We're just further along. We have seen many things fulfilled, at least in part, but we have yet to see the whole. So my hope today is to first help us see that what the original context of this section was is an answer to a hanging question in the air of those who return from exile, of what now? We're in this in-between. Well, today we're still in the in-between. So this section still applies to us. We're just in a different in-between, if you will. So as we look to this final section here, as we look to the final section of Isaiah, what I'm going to first focus on is the first 8 verses of chapter 56. And I'm going to read these and I'm going to talk about them. So chapter 56, "Thus says the Lord, keep justice and do righteousness, for soon my salvation will come, and my righteousness will be revealed. Blessed is the man who does this, and the son of man who holds it fast, who keeps the Sabbath, not profaning it, and keeps his hand from doing any evil. Let not the foreigner who has joined himself to the Lord say, the Lord will surely separate me from his people. And let not the eunuch say, behold, I am a dry tree. For thus says the Lord, to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbath, who choose the things that please me, and hold fast my covenant, I will give in my house and within my walls a monument and a name. Better than sons and daughters, I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. And the foreigner who joins themselves to the Lord, to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord, and to be his servants, everyone who keeps the Sabbath and does not profane it, and holds fast my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain, and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar. For my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples. The Lord God, who gathers the outcasts of Israel, declares, I will gather yet others to him besides those already gathered." The opening 8 verses of chapter 56 read a lot like the opening and closing of the book of Revelation. Keep justice, do righteousness, for soon my salvation will come, and my righteousness will be revealed. In other words, this is a call to keep the faith, if you will, for the promises are coming. Sounds a lot like the beginning and the end of Revelation. It's on purpose. As I have studied these sections, I think it would maybe be more helpful to change how I have this last section titled in my outline and change it from, as you see, 56 to 66 there, the end, the conqueror. We should maybe change it to what now? Living in righteousness while waiting for the end. What do we do now? What now? How are we to live in light of these promises as we wait for them? We have seen in part, but when will we see in full? And what are we to do until then? These are the questions that the returned from exile would be asking. And these are the questions that we still ask today. And these, by the way, are some of the most helpful questions to ask as you read Revelation as well. Because it is a book about the end, but it is also a book about what now? What do we do as we wait? That's why it opens and closes with a call to faithfulness, just like this section of Isaiah does. So to the exiles who have returned back to their homeland, the promised land, but who have yet to see the fullness of the promises, Isaiah turns his prophetic voice and gives them instructions and encouragement, and I think his voice still offers the same for us today. These opening words, keep justice, do righteousness, these are a call to act with integrity and fairness towards others, and this is justice. And they're also a call to correctly observe the laws of God and seek to be like him, and this is righteousness. In other words, this is a call to love God and love others. Sound familiar? It's kind of a consistent theme throughout the whole Bible. These two terms, justice and righteousness, have been paired many times throughout the book of Isaiah as a summary for God and also for what his people ought to be characterized by, and they also are a summary of his redemption and what it will be characterized by. So in other words, what is being said is live like you ought. Live out my heart while you wait. Soon my salvation will come and my righteousness will be revealed. And in the meantime, you are to be, you get to be, the visible sign, the visible image of my righteousness until my righteousness is fully revealed. That's what you get to be in the meantime. So hold fast, keep my Sabbath, and keep your hand from doing evil. The Sabbath here is, I think, put in focus because as a verse later in this section explains, chapter 58, verse 13, it explains that this Sabbath represents a commitment to prioritize living the way that God has directed. To prioritize, in other words, him. The Sabbath represents putting God first rather than your own way. Because the Sabbath, especially culturally speaking, was a direct contradiction to how the world wanted to live and how people thought life should work. You saw that as Caleb worked through the book of Nehemiah and what the people fell back to immediately trying to do commerce and trying to invite people in for trading and basically just doing what they wanted to do on the Sabbath. And Nehemiah has to step in and say, no, that is not what God has directed for the Sabbath. You put him first. For a whole day, you remind yourself that he is first. And that should be a weekly reminder of his centrality in your life. So as this blessing opens then to all, as verses 3 through 8 explain, this blessing, this call to put him first, this call to prioritize the Sabbath and to turn to God, it opens to all. These verses 3 through 8 say, let not the foreigner say, basically, put my own words here to summarize what's going on. Let not the foreigner say, I have no place here. And let not the eunuch say, I have no future here. For those who keep the Sabbath, or in other words, prioritize God and choose his way, those who hold to the covenant, those who choose God, who minister to him and love him, they will be his servants. Yes, we see this term morphing yet again. Because we saw that those who look to the servant become his servants. And now just to make it clear, as we're talking about foreigners and eunuchs, those who would seemingly not be invited to the temple, God says, yes, they are also my servants if they look to me. And if you extend it out to the context, what he's meaning is if you look to my servant, anybody can become a servant. They will all be gathered and welcomed into his holy mountain, these verses say, and into his house, for his house shall be called a house of prayer for all people. A little flash forward to the New Testament there. Why does Jesus get so mad and kicks people out of his temple? Notice that it is this verse that he claims in that context. He kicks them out and says, my house is a house of prayer. And what he's alluding to here is a house of prayer for all people. What was going on in that context is they had turned to the outer court, which is supposed to be the court of the Gentiles, a reminder that they are to be a light to the nations and drawing people in. They had turned it instead into a court of commerce, making profit. In other words, self-seeking, turning inward, rather than being a light facing outward to give light to the people. And that is why Jesus gets so mad, because they have reversed it. And as the section ends here, it says, for the Lord who gathers the outcasts of Israel declares, I will gather yet others to him besides those already gathered. So the challenge and the call then in 56:1-8 is to live in justice and righteousness while waiting for the fulfillment of the promises and while welcoming in anyone who joins themselves to the Lord. And this serves as a good summary of chapters 56 to 66, and it is expanded out through these chapters in a way that beautifully weaves together all the themes and imagery of the entire book of Isaiah. These all come gloriously into 56 and 66, woven together and reaching their climax in these chapters. And what I am going to do, I know you're maybe panicking because I'm only on 56 verse 8 and we already like halfway through our time or more. But what I am going to do with the remaining time today is give an outline and a summary of how these chapters expand out this call. What I would say is 56, 1 through 8 is a summary, a core of what is going to happen in 56 to 66, and we see it all through the outline of what continues to happen. So I'd encourage you to read it more after today and dig into it further. But the outline is purposefully simple that I have for this. It doesn't look simple because it's long, but it's 11 chapters, guys. So what's going on in this outline, like I said, it's a chiasm, so it's kind of hard to split in half because the main theme is at the middle. Look who's at the middle. The servant. Shouldn't surprise us that he's there. So this outline is purposely simple to bring out the main points and flow of the text. And you will also notice, again, that it is built with the theme in the middle. But this does not mean that each side is exactly identical. Because that is one danger that you can read a commentary, look at an outline, it's like, oh, it's chiasm. I'm like, oh, it's exactly the same. So I just read the first half and I'm good to go. No. That's usually, sometimes that is how chiasms work, but it's usually not how they work. Usually it is similar on each side, but there is a build throughout the whole. But if you miss the fact that it is a chiasm and the theme is at the middle, if you miss that, you understand the build improperly. So I'm going to keep pointing us back to the middle as we work through it. But each of the halves emphasize the themes in a slightly different way, and there's a continual build throughout. So as we look to these chapters, I'm going to kind of briefly read what's going on and then in the outline here, and then I'm going to explain it. And again, I'm not going to answer all your questions about these 11 chapters. I'm sorry. I'm just going to give an overview here. But as we look to this outline here, what you first have is the servants called to righteousness. And those are the verses that I just talked about. This expansion, this continual morphing here of the themes, you had all the beginning of Isaiah, the kind of focus of the servant or servant's imagery was the nation of Israel, and then you have their task taken up by the servant who is actually able to accomplish it. And then you have the servant imagery expand out to servants, those who look to the servant. And then just to make sure that's clear, in the first 8 verses of 56, it specifies that anybody who joins themselves to God can be a servant, is part of the servants. And you see in these verses this call to righteousness, this call to what do we do in the in-between? You live out my heart where you are. That's what you do. And then in the next section, discouragingly so, you have the complete inability of the people to do that. And then you have ending that section, you have a divine warrior who goes into battle. And then you have this section of future glory, these promises are just continuously throughout the book of Isaiah, this future glory of what will be. And then in the middle of this, and I purposely have D split up, because if you look at a lot of commentaries, 60 to 62 is all one center of the chiasm, but I don't think that makes it clear enough that the servant is purposefully in the center. Because 61, 1, 2, 3 is almost, like if word count wise, it's almost in the middle of the section. He is the middle on purpose, because all of this stuff doesn't happen without his work, without him accomplishing the task. So the servant is at the middle of this future glory section that as you descend back down, what's cool is that leading into this future glory and the servant, you have the divine warrior goes into battle, and then the immediate section after these promises and the servant being put on a pedestal, put on the mountain peak of this chiasm, the divine warrior who went into battle, in those verses you read him putting on his armor. And then in the very next section leading out of this, you see he wins the battle. Because the section before, the divine warrior going into battle, it talks about how he will do this. Kurt talked about these verses, that he will do this for the sake of making his name known, that he will show himself. He will do this on his own. As the book of Isaiah has made clear, he is God. And then you see in this divine warrior wins the battle, it's this lone warrior figure. Who, it is fairly graphic, yes, he is standing in the blood of those that he has conquered. The point is, he put on his armor, and guess what? He won. He will win. He will always win, because he is God. That is the point of that section. And then as you continue down, you have the inability of the people matched by the ability of God. As you look to those chapters in that section there, 63 to most of 66. And why the reason for that reversal there, the inability that leads into the center and then the ability of God that leads out of the center, why you have that is that the people at the beginning are trying to do it on their own. And then you build towards the servant who does what we cannot do and wins the battle for us. That's where God's ability enters in. And then it ends with the servants who were called to righteousness are now clothed in righteousness. So you have this build that happens through this chiasm here. And I didn't want to make it too complicated with the chiasm. So again, it's purposely simple. But one thing just to point out that adds even more depth into these sections here, on the first half of that chiasm there, A through C, which is, again, the servants called to righteousness, and then the inability of the people, and then the divine warrior going into battle, putting on his armor. You have within this, which is a pattern, you have that pattern actually repeated twice, but just for the sake of space up there and simplicity of the chiasm, I did the main pattern, just showing it once. But you have in the beginning, 56, 1 through 8, and then also in 58, 1 through 14, both of these passages speak of how the house and the family of God is made up of those who seek him and live in righteousness and justice, not simply those who are born to the right nation or family or who do the right motions. And man, has that been a theme in Isaiah. Right at the beginning, where in chapters 1 through 5, he talks about the emptiness and fakeness of their religion, basically that their religion is a lie, and he says, get out. You're doing your religion without my heart. You've missed the point. And now you have a call here and a reminder that those who are, to continue the words we've used throughout, those who are the servants are those who have God's heart, those who live for him, those who trust God and live for him, which, by the way, has been the same call that we talked about repeatedly through 1 through 39, the call to trust God and put him first. Don't live in your own ways, but live in God's ways. Don't do your religion for the sake of manipulating him, but do your religion because you're actually seeking him. That's been the call all along. And then both of these sections here that have this call and have this reminder of who is actually in the family of God, both of these are followed by a statement of the inability of the people to live like this in their own strength. And this is seen in 56, 9 through 57, 13, and also in 59, 1 through 15a. And yes, it is specifically 59, 15a, because the breaking of the verses there is unhelpful. But you see the inability of the people to live this way in their own and in their own strength. And this is the same exact failure that we saw through chapters 1 through 39. So you see how these themes of Isaiah are coming to an end here and being continued. And then finally, each series ends with a promise that God will come and fight for them and will enable this righteousness that he commands. We see this promise, this fact that he will do it. We see this in 57, 14 to 21. And then we also see it in 59b through 21. So again, you have this call to live in righteousness. These are the people who are in the family of God. And you have the complete inability of the people to do it. And then starting in 59, the second half of 15, the Lord saw it, and it displeased him. There was no justice. He saw that there was no man, and wondered that there was no one to intercede. Then his own arm brought him salvation, and his righteousness upheld him. He put on righteousness as a breastplate, and a helmet of salvation on his head. He put on garments of vengeance for clothing, and wrapped himself in zeal as a cloak. According to their deeds, so he will repay wrath to his adversaries, repayment to his enemies. To the coastlands he will render payment. So they shall fear the Lord from the west, and his glory from the rising of the sun. For he will come like a rushing stream, which the wind of the Lord drives. And you read that, that's terrifying. But then you read 20, and a redeemer will come to Zion. Why is he putting his armor on? There is judgment, yes, but there is also redemption. He puts his armor on to do both. A redeemer will come to Zion, to those in Jacob who turn from transgression, declares the Lord. And as for me, this is my covenant with them. My spirit that is upon you and my words that I have put in your mouth shall not depart out of your mouth or out of the mouth of your offspring or out of the mouth of your children's offspring from this time forth and forevermore. The divine warrior comes and puts on his armor and fights for us because he saw that we couldn't do it. And then in D through E of this outline, which is the middle there, like the visions of chapter 2 and chapter 4 and many of the Messiah and servant passages, these chapters speak of a restored, purified Jerusalem with God's salvation and glory on full display and the nations coming to learn about the Lord. We see kind of a glimpse of the hope that we had seen in 2 through 4, and we see kind of glimpses and bright spots of it throughout chapters 6 through 39, and now we see it on full display in chapters 60 through 62, three whole chapters of it. 61, 1 through 3 is centered in this passage as the mountain peak, if you will, of 56 to 66. In these three short verses, all of the promises of the servant, the Messiah, the King of the line of David, the Redeemer, the Conqueror, the Comforter, just keep putting titles in there, all of them are placed on the shoulders of the one anointed by the Lord and whom the Spirit of the Lord rests on. All of this is possible because of him. So in 61, 1 through 3, it says, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and the opening of prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant to those who mourn in Zion, to give them a beautiful headdress instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the garment of praise instead of a faint spirit, and they may be called oaks of righteousness, the plantings of the Lord, that he may be glorified." Almost every single word in those three verses comes from earlier in Isaiah and is a fulfillment that sits on the shoulders of this one anointed by God. So this is the center, the mountain peak of this outline. And to reinforce this fact that he sits at the mountain peak, the servant is the one who makes all of this possible. To reinforce this, D and E, the center here, 60 to 61, are flanked by the divine warrior to remind us that all of this is made possible because he fights for us on his own. That's why you have the imagery of the lone warrior here. You see in the flank immediately preceding it that he puts on his armor, and then the flank immediately after it that he has and will win. There's a purposeful flanking here of these promises with the divine warrior. And then as we look to the last part of the outline here, the second C through A in descending order, just as A through C, the first ones, had a pattern within a pattern, so also these have a pattern within a pattern. And this pattern focuses on the Lord's ability and his way rather than ours. It starts again with the divine warrior, the lone warrior who will be victorious. He will win. And he does this, again, you have to always keep in mind that mountain peak, the servant, the divine warrior wins because of his work accomplished through the servant. The servant is the warrior. He is the divine warrior, and the servant makes all this possible. He is able. But you have a response. As we've seen so many times, you have a response of disbelief. In 63, 7 through 64, 12, what you essentially have as a response from the people is, "But where are you? You have these grand promises. You've told us that you're putting on your armor and that you're fighting. Where are you?" It's the same response that we've seen so many times through the book of Isaiah, this response of disbelief, this looking to like, well, when? Where is it? What's going on? Where are you? Why haven't you saved us from our bondage to sin? Are you able? So you have this grand promise of he is able. The divine warrior who put on his armor will be victorious. He is able. But a response of, are you able? And then God answers beautifully in 65. He answers, "I am here." He says, "I was ready to be sought by those who did not ask, and I was ready to be found by those who did not seek me." He said, "Here I am. Here I am." So he answers this call. He says, "I am here, but you didn't seek me as I asked, but in your own way, which will lead to your own destruction," is what you see in 65, 1 to 16. And that also, by the way, is hearkening back to Isaiah 50, 10 through 11, the imagery of the torch, that those who look to the servant will have a torch that lights their way in the darkness, but those who light their own torch will only walk to destruction. It's the same exact imagery coming back here. So this ability, and then question of his ability that's responded to with his ability, you just have to look to him, is then followed by a pattern of hope, judgment, hope, judgment, hope. And this happens in 65:17 through 66:24, which is the end of the book. And this is a purposeful reversal, by the way, of the pattern of judgment, hope, judgment, hope, judgment, seen in 1 through 5. I'm going to put that up so you can see what I mean. The beginning and the end of Isaiah purposefully mirror each other, but in a mirror opposite way. The opening chapters of Isaiah, as we talked about many weeks ago, you have judgment, which like had little glimpses of hope, and then you have the glimpses in just like short sections, 2:1-4, you have hope. And then judgment, this long section of judgment at the middle. Then you have this short 5 verses of hope in 4:2-6. And then you have judgment again in chapter 5, the last chapter of the introduction. And it basically ends with the thought, it's like, is there no hope? That's how the book opens. Focused on judgment, glimpses of hope, but question of hope. And the end of Isaiah answers that perfectly by reversing all those. And saying, yes, there is still judgment. Judgment for those who do not look to and bow to the work of the servant. But because of what he has done, hope is greater. That even though you are completely unable, and even though all hope seems lost, hope will win because of the work of the servant. So the opening question at the beginning of the book is matched and mirrored at the end. And rather than judgment having the focus, at the end, hope has the focus. God is able. In this section, you see that God is able to create or recreate the heavens and the earth, Jerusalem and his people, which will include all peoples. Because of the work of the servant, hope has won out against judgment. There is still judgment for those who do not submit to the work of the servant, but there is hope available to anyone of any nation who bows to him. Through him, anyone, as we see in the closing here, 66, verse 21, and we have to realize how scandalous this would have been to the original audience, but through the work of the servant, as we close out here in this message of hope, 66:21 says, and some of them also I will take for priests and for Levites, says the Lord. And in the context, that is the nations. It says, not only can anyone become a servant who looks to the servant, but they will even become as priests. It is a complete morphing of this servant language and completely surprising to what you would have expected. But through him, anyone can now become a priest and a Levite made holy by him. So as we close out this book of Isaiah, we face the same question that is the driving question for this whole last section of the book. What now? Our what now is the same as theirs was all those years ago. Look to the servant. We know his name now, so look to Jesus. He is your only hope and your only strength. Live in righteousness and justice, which, as I explained, love God, love others. The same thing Jesus said that summarizes how to follow him. Love God, love others through the help that he offers by the sending of his Spirit. The Lord is making a new creation, and it starts now with the new creation that he seeks to make in you as you submit to Jesus. Because when Jesus came, we read in Luke 4 that he read some of Isaiah 61:1-3, which remember that this is the climax. So this isn't just Jesus humbly and kind of vaguely saying, I am the servant. He purposely chooses the text that is the climax of the entire book of Isaiah to point to all of the promises of Isaiah. And says, today this scripture has been fulfilled. The servant arrived. We have yet to see, though, the complete fulfillment of everything in Isaiah. In fact, you kind of see that in what he's reading. He leaves out a couple lines because he knows that there's some stuff yet to come. But God's plan was in motion, and it took a giant leap forward when he came. He accomplished the work of Isaiah 53, and he has given us a foretaste of the promises yet to be fulfilled. He has sent us his Spirit as promised to those who believe. And Paul in 2 Corinthians 5:17 rightly saw that the salvation and the indwelling by the Spirit that Jesus made possible was the start of a new creation. We are new creations in Christ. Hearkening from words here in Isaiah, he says then in 2 Corinthians 5:17, old things have passed away, all things have become new. So our what now is that God calls you to not simply wait for the new creation that will come, but to take part in it today as he recreates you through the work of the servant. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you again for this book. I thank you that you know our frame, that you knew and know that we are completely unable in our own strength to follow you, and that you sent your son, your servant, to make a way for us, to have your spirit in us, enabling us to do what we can't. And I pray that as we humble ourselves to the work of the servant, as we acknowledge that he is Lord, and as we submit to his spirit that he has sent for us to mold us and reshape us and recreate us, that we would, as we're called to in the opening verses there of 56, that we would be your righteousness to the world around us, that we would be the light that your people have always been called to be to the world, and that we would say yes to this work of recreation that you seek to do in us. And I pray this in your name. Amen.